Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents We Shook Up the World, The Spiritual Rebellion of Muhammad Ali and George Harrison, by Tracy Doherty. Narrated by Gabriel Vaughan. A man does not attain freedom from the results of action by abstaining from actions, and he does not approach perfection simply by renunciation. For the mere maintenance of the world, you should act. Whatever the greatest man does, thus do the rest. Whatever standard he sets, the world follows that. Bhagavad Gita. A man is worked on by what he works on. He may carve out his circumstances, but his circumstances will carve him out as well. Frederick Douglass. The rubble had been cleared away, but strange grasses and wild herbs had sprung up where the war-demolished houses had been. Muriel Spark. Prologue. You don't ever want to die. It is a global story. In reliving it, we will travel far in distance and in time, beginning with early February 1974. George Harrison had flown to India for the first time in 6 years to stay with his friend and mentor, the sitar player Ravi Shankar, to visit Varanasi, also known as Benares, and to return to the holy city of Vrindavan on the banks of the Ganges, said by some to be Krishna's birthplace. The Beatles had disbanded. Harrison's marriage was ending, and he was grieving for his mother, recently dead from cancer. His commitments to India's sacred texts and prayerful chanting had profoundly changed his relationship to Western music and the music industry. Despite impressive commercial success as a solo artist in the immediate post-Beatles years, he was already suffering attacks from mainstream rock and roll journalists over his droning compositions and didactic song lyrics. He was 31 years old. He had spent a decade as one of the world's most famous men. Now he hoped to revitalize his faith, energy, and musical inspirations on the trip to India. At the heart of his renewal was the visit to Varanasi, the center of the earth in Hindu cosmology. He wanted a reminder, a vivid means of placing human life in perspective in the context of death. Years earlier, in the beginning of his relationship with Patty Boyd, who had now left their marriage for Harrison's buddy, Eric Clapton, Harrison had gone to Varanasi to watch the sacred burning of corpses. Ashes washed in the Ganges were thought to be blessed. It was an astonishing sight to see bodies burning on the banks as we stepped out of a boat, Boyd recalled years later in her memoir. I was unable to look away, although I wanted to. In a separate reminiscence, she wrote that bears and monkeys on chains in the streets, besides beggars and mutilated children, appeared wherever they went in Mumbai, Jodhpur, or Jaipur. Shankar introduced the couple to his spiritual guru, Tatwali Baba, said by his devotees to have ceased aging when he was 35. Tat Baba explained the laws of karma, of action and reaction, to Harrison. In Varanasi, Harrison observed the sadhus, mendicants who'd renounced the material world, chanting and soliciting food in the streets. Shankar took the couple to Kumbh Mela, a Hindu festival held, among other locations, at the confluence of the Ganges, Yamuna, and Saraswati rivers. Kumbh Mela is celebrated roughly in 12-year cycles, determined by the astrological positions of the sun, moon, and Jupiter. It is one of the largest peaceful gatherings in the world. Kumbh, a term first recorded in the Rig Veda, is Sanskrit for pitcher. In Vedic texts, it is associated with the nectar of immortality. Mela means to meet. The festival is a union near the waters of eternal life. Pilgrims feed monks, feed the poor, and bathe themselves in the rivers, chanting rhythmic prayers to cleanse their sins. We found ourselves in a crowd of about 3,000, most of whom had come on foot from across India, Boyd recalled. I remember sitting with Ravi at the festival and seeing a man with a bamboo stick sitting nearby. He kept putting his tongue into the stick, so I asked Ravi what he was doing. He explained that a snake was inside the stick, and he was getting a little bit of venom to get high. Late in the day, Harrison bought a banki tandai, a yogurt and almond drink laced with hashish, legal in Varanasi, associated with Shiva's sacraments. After a few sips, he viewed the rising full moon and the pink dust shimmering in the air as from a great distance in time, as if from another life. But it was the body burning that made the most indelible impression. The setting sun, as darkly orange as flaming coal, slanted through clouds of roiling smoke as men in groups of three, silent and black as underworld couriers, carried corpses wrapped in white linen to the riverbank. In firelight flickering among the ghats, the stone steps descending into the river's west side, the linens glowed like alabaster lamps, ruffled by rounded lumps, heads stiff with rigor mortis, or pierced among the folds by bruised arms and legs dumbly animated by the carrier's motions. The carriers entered the water and placed the bodies into wooden boats rocking on lulling waves. The boatmen shifted their bamboo oars. The instruments creaked in stirrups made of twine. Incense and smoky body oils choked the thickening air. The river, its surface agitated, dull as weathered tin, waited. Once more now, in early February 1974, Harrison was startled and moved by the rising flames, the smoke, the bodies, juices, and odors, the incense and flowers accompanying the dead to the banks of the river, the swarms of ashes in the purple evening sky. Earlier, he had walked through the center of Varanasi, past unhurried cows, pigs, and goats, the carcasses of puppies crushed by tractors and tuk-tuks, erratic auto rickshaws, and the street market buzzing like wasps, offering cashmere and silk, hand-rolled cigarettes, and illegally recorded music on cheap cassettes, including the Beatles. He had wound his way toward the ghats, near the spot where it was said the Buddha delivered his first sermon, to stand among sadhus, shrunken inside thin, peach-tinted robes, among women wrapped in saris selling lemon-colored parrots. He stood among girls beating laundry on the gritty, wet steps, men soaping the sides of apparently indifferent water buffalo. He stood among the many open-air cremations, the loud crackling, the light like circles of fireflies, among the dying and the dead, savoring the Ganges' promise of salvation. It was an irony, or a paradox. This most pure spot was also among the filthiest patches on earth. Human life reduced to its essence, divinity and dust. In this place, the closest place to heaven that he knew, his perspective always widened. Before he'd made this trip, friends back in England had been urging him to take his music on the road, to capitalize on the recent success of his albums. He had soured on touring long ago, after the Beatles' tumultuous experiences in 1966, when they endured death threats, especially in the American South, following John Lennon's remark that the band was more popular than Jesus. The Beatles saga had been a nightmare, Harrison always said. But that was the narrow view. Here in Varanasi, he could almost imagine traveling again, sharing with audiences the pleasures of Indian ragas, evoking the profound truths he was witnessing now by the Ganges. He could imagine the joy of bringing this experience to people, journeying with fellow players who saw what he did in music, a devotional practice, a way of putting God into sound. Meanwhile, in the Pennsylvania woods, just off Route 61, 32-year-old Muhammad Ali training to regain his heavyweight boxing title in a fight with George Foreman, was also obsessed with mortality. Like George Harrison, he had spent the past 10 years as a worldwide celebrity, earning both extravagant praise and critical barbs. Early one morning in July 1974, he left his rural training camp in a white Cadillac on his way to a nearby boys' camp. The boys' camp had been established to rehabilitate juvenile troublemakers using tactics of tough love, putting them to work chopping trees and clearing brush. Ali had agreed to stage a boxing exhibition to entertain the boys. He loved doing this sort of thing, and it was good PR in this pastoral, largely white artists' community where he'd chosen to erect his compound. "I love the feel here," he told his friends. "There's lots of energy." But some of the locals remained leery of him. They had not forgotten or forgiven his view on race, on Vietnam. So he staged goodwill demonstrations throughout Schuylkill County and kept his camp open to visitors. On this warm July morning, he had eaten an early breakfast, fixed for him by Lana Shabazz, a member of his staff. Then he'd hopped into his caddy. On his way to the boys' camp, he was accompanied by Dave Kindred, a sports writer from the Louisville Courier-Journal, Ali's hometown paper, and an old pal of Kindred's. Kindred reported the story later. Ali wheeled his car erratically down steep logging roads, deeply rutted, topping 85 miles per hour, talking up a storm. Kindred and his buddy glanced at each other. They feared for their lives. "Muhammad, are you afraid of dying?" Kindred asked him. "You don't ever want to die," Ali said. "Glad to hear that. But the man who built this road is dead now. The man who built that farmhouse over there is dead. There are guys I fought, Sonny Liston, Zora Fole, Eddie Machen, Alejandro Lavarante, dead. Liston rotten in his grave. Nobody cares." Liston, Ali's first major opponent, had died in 1970 under a fog of rumors, spread by Elvis Presley, among others, that the Las Vegas mob, for whom Liston allegedly dealt drugs, had murdered him, injecting him with heroin. "We ain't nothing," Ali continued in the car. "We're nobody. We don't own nothing on this earth. We just borrow things. When you die, another man comes along and your daughter calls him daddy." He took a right turn onto a narrow, twisting deer path. "Death is the tax the soul has to pay for having a name and a form." In camp, sometimes in the evenings after a day-long workout, he'd gather his entourage around the ring along with a smattering of visitors. "I want to say something right now," he'd announce. "This might make you all think. Life is not really long. Let's say the average person is 30 years old. If you're 30 years old, you're not but about 7 years old. Add up all the 7, 8, 9 hours you slept for 30 years. Out of 30 years, add up all the nights when you went to bed and this morning don't remember a thing. You've been unconscious for about 8 years if you're 30 years old. How much traveling have you done in 30 years? From home to another country, to another city, to school, to church. You've probably spent 2 years of your life just going back and forth to where you're going. So there's 8 years of sleeping and 2 years of traveling." He challenged his listeners to contemplate time spent sitting in school, in movie theaters, in sports stadiums. "So life is real short. Add up your traveling, add up all your sleeping, add up all your school, add up all your entertainment. You've probably spent half your life doing nothing." The best thing a person could do, he'd insist, was prepare to meet God. God wants to know, how do we treat each other? How do we help each other? After a decade of unprecedented fame, of magnificent achievements starting to fade, perhaps it was natural for George Harrison and Muhammad Ali to consider finality. Already in 1974, it was apparent that none of the ex-Beatles would ever escape the weight of their years as lovable mop tops, no matter how accomplished they became as individuals. It was clear that, after a lengthy layoff from the ring, the result of his conflict with the U.S. government over the war in Southeast Asia, Ali would never again be the athlete he was, even if he did manage to make an astonishing comeback. In general, the 1970s was a period of dishonor and dysfunction, a time of deepening shame, in the words of writer Richard Hoffer, particularly in America. The late great Planet Earth, by Hal Lindsey, predicting an immediate apocalypse, became the decade's biggest international bestseller. Inflation, the Arab oil embargo, the energy crisis, Kent State, the scandals of Watergate and My Lai, the humiliation of the unfolding endgames in Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos. The 60s mantra of revolution had devolved into Andy Warhol's repeated Mao paintings, begun in 1972, the leader's round face flattened, deliberately superficial, the commercial packaging of protest. New West magazine called the pet rock the perfect 70s symbol. It just sat there doing nothing. Harrison and Ali had been honored, and they'd been burdened by their symbolic status as cultural representatives. In the 1960s, Ali became one of the most charismatic people on the planet. His stance against the war enshrined him as an icon of the decade's revolutionary spirit, loved by some, hated by others. Harrison used his celebrity in the 60s to forge paths between Eastern philosophy and Western religion, mixing Eastern and Western music, a cultural revolution no less momentous than the period's political upheavals. He broke musical boundaries by combining rockabilly rhythms, country, blues, and Indian classical music. Ali altered boxing by jabbing and dancing in the ring, keeping his hands down, countervailing traditional wisdom. Theirs were rebellions of style, spreading, influencing bigger social spheres. These men had been uniquely positioned to lead in a violently disruptive time. But now the press noted Ali's receding youth and the Beatles' breakup as signs of the period's erosion. Yet it was in 1974, following Harrison's trip to India and Ali's training regimen in Pennsylvania, that both men embarked on highly visible ventures, large-scale gestures capping all they had accomplished and hoped to achieve in the previous decade. Historians have often cited 1974 as a useful endpoint for what we loosely call the 1960s. Richard Nixon's resignation of the presidency and the retreat of U.S. military forces from Vietnam together provide a solid demarcation between the cultural 60s and their aftermath. The public receptions given to Harrison's and Ali's activities in 1974 offer remarkable insights into how America began to process its immediate past and tried to shape a future. Ironies lined the lives of George Harrison and Muhammad Ali, suggesting how unlikely each life story was, how easily the stories might never have happened, how quickly the whole could have unraveled. Harrison lived the freewheeling life of a rock star, openly admitting he'd engaged in serial sexual affairs and drug experimentation, yet above all else, his fans revered him in the late 60s for his heartfelt expressions of the period's spiritual yearning. How can people consider Ali a historic figure from the 1960s? Mark Cram, a Sports Illustrated writer, once asked a fellow reporter. He wasn't for civil rights. He was for separation of the races. He wasn't for women's rights. He treated them like second-class call girls. He was never really against the war. He was told not to go by his spiritual leader, Elijah Muhammad, because it would be a PR disaster for the Muslims. These were the hot issues of the 60s, and he was on the wrong side of history in all of them. Yet people today somehow think Ali belongs right next to Martin Luther King. In part, this book explores the puzzles of why people considered Muhammad Ali an important cultural figure, and how George Harrison encouraged spirituality from the raging center ring of sex, drugs, and rock and roll. Ironies are never simple. Nor were these men. Nor were the times. Harrison's path crossed Ali's only on a few occasions, yet their names are linked in history. In tracing their parallel careers and insisting on crucial ties between them, I am countering an intuitive view that, of the Beatles, John Lennon most warranted comparisons with Ali. Both men were confident, aggressive, and brash. Both came to be associated publicly with the anti-war movement. In contrast, Harrison was less outspoken and wary of his celebrity. Yet the similarities between Lennon and Ali did not extend far below the surface. It was Harrison who shared with the fighter a profound and genuine spiritual awareness. His struggle to maintain his spirituality in the glare of a celebrity culture more outlandish than the world had ever known lent a special gravity to his career matched closely by Ali's. No other popular figures traveled their paths quite, or achieved what they did as a result of their choices. Risking their livelihoods, they rejected the Christianity and many of the Western values held by a majority of their audiences. They embraced religious practices considered exotic and strange by many of their devoted followers. Most importantly, their achievements were significantly altered and defined by the choices they made. Their parallel movements placed them at the center of the post-colonial world's dramatic shifts. Because of the borders they crossed, spiritual, cultural, and geographic, and because new technologies elevated their fame to stratospheric levels, George Harrison and Muhammad Ali, more than any of their pop cultural peers, came to embody the world that made them. In turn, they helped fashion that world. In retrospect, Harrison's involvement with Eastern cultures, his efforts on behalf of Bangladesh, and Ali's contact with Africa and contradictory stances on Pan-African movements reframe our understanding of what occurred worldwide in the 1960s and 1970s. Thus, the details of these men's stories become markers in a much broader tale, a tale at the heart of this book, the shattering of the post-colonial world and the rise and fall of the American century. Harrison and Ali became lead characters in this narrative. Their stories came to us through fresh lines of communication dreamed into existence, it seemed, for the sole purpose of enchanting us with these particular figures. Ali and the Beatles were new, as were our ways of knowing them, as were the visions they revealed to us, intentionally or not. For Americans of the baby boom generation, Harrison and his mates shrank global distances. When Harrison turned to Indian aesthetics for his sustenance, he, in particular, educated international audiences about the tremors they were feeling. Many of Ali's fights occurred in locations exotic to most Americans. Zaire, the once and future Congo, Malaysia, the Philippines, the Bahamas. These venues were settled on through complex and often shady negotiations involving international banking laws and personal and corporate hustles. But they also materialized because dictators leading these fledgling countries wanted to prove to their former masters that they had arrived on the world scene. They believed the quickest way to do this was to host the world's most famous man, to surround him with spectacle. Even more satisfying for them, in the 1960s, when he first became Muhammad Ali, the world's most famous man had resisted the world's greatest superpower and won his battle with its government. Receiving him in splendor was much more gratifying, more symbolically potent, than receiving a U.S. president. It is impossible to speak of Muhammad Ali's late career without considering its post-colonial nature. Just as his early fights cannot be severed from America's civil rights struggles. As Ali noted on the eve of his bout with George Foreman in Zaire in 1974, many nations go to war to attract attention. It was so much cheaper to invite him to fight. In 1974, Harrison mounted his U.S. tour, the first ex-Beatle to tour the States since the band's end, just when Ali had staged his championship comeback against Foreman. As a result, Western nations had a chance to reevaluate the recent past through two of their most powerful social symbols. The spectacle of a touring Beatle, he would never really be an ex, and a jabbing Ali, defying time's sucker punch, gave observers a moment to ponder their present and consider how they got there, and to ask what they wanted from the future. If it seems odd to suggest that entertainment provided as much opportunity for historical reassessment as politics or the day's unfolding tragedies, we will see, during the course of this story, how central popular culture had become to grasping and spreading information, and how thoroughly bound pop culture was to current events. Not only was the Beatles' sound evocative of the 1960s, it was also a product of the period's technology and social rhythms. Not only were Ali's fights distilled versions of America's racial tensions, they were also, in some cases, virtual life and death struggles. As Joyce Carol Oates observed in her book, On Boxing, the sweet science is not a metaphor for life. It is life. This book is mostly about the 1960s, but 1974, a pivotal year in the careers of George Harrison and Muhammad Ali, becomes the culminating peak here because it was a moment when both men's values were tested. That year, their achievements and, in many ways, those of the masses, were placed in stark perspective. But the importance of 1974 cannot be grasped without understanding what preceded it and what occurred in its aftermath. Part 1. The Shaken World. Chapter 1. The Quiet One and the Marvelous Mouth. The world trembled in the 1960s. Ancient national alignments frayed as many of the geopolitical arrangements made after World War II unraveled in uprisings and demands for independence, roiling the global economy and undermining cultural foundations planet-wide. The lives of George Harrison and Muhammad Ali would be resoundingly altered by such events. These men absorbed the rhythms of change and helped spread them by means of the fresh technologies fueling their fame and much of the world's turbulence. The 1960s, culturally defined here as running from the late 1950s to the mid-1970s, began, broadly speaking, with glimmers of political hope, represented most forcefully in the West by the youthful face of John F. Kennedy. By the period's end, old colonial outposts, particularly in the East, lay in shambles, their detritus flowing straight into the West's gluttonous bloodstream, sometimes a poison, sometimes a glorious high. The world's power of self-destruction was awesome to behold. It is not an overstatement to say that the destiny of the entire human race depends on what is going on in America today. Eldridge Cleaver had written in Soul on Ice, "This is a staggering reality to the rest of the world. They must feel like passengers in a supersonic jetliner who are forced to watch helplessly while a passel of drunks, hypes, freaks, and madmen fight for the controls and the pilot's seat." In 1970, John Lennon sang "The Dream is Over," referring to the end of the Beatles and indirectly to the rebellious spirit of the 1960s. But that spirit wasn't quite exhausted. In 1974, Lennon's former bandmate, George Harrison, returned to America, where the Beatles' fame had always been greatest. In what turned out to be in many ways a career-culminating spectacle, he showcased the values he believed lay at the heart of the 60s. At the same time, Muhammad Ali, whose rise to fame had coincided with that of the Beatles, and who would always be linked to them, made a bold attempt to reclaim the glory he had gained in the preceding decade. He claimed to share that glory with those who lived the dream. The importance of Harrison's and Ali's high visibility in 1974 began 10
Sample complete. Ready to continue?